Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a community perspective episode with Dr. James Guest. I'm one of your hosts, David.
And I'm your new host, Faria. Today, we will be discussing the paper titled Non-Invasive Spinal Cord Electrical Stimulation for Arm and Hand Function in Chronic Tetraplegia, a Safety and Efficacy Trial, which was published in Nature Medicine in May of 2024. This paper was submitted to us by Asia's Research Committee, and our guest today is Dr. James Guest. Dr. James Guest is MD, PhD, and a fellow of ANS. He's a professor of neurological surgery at the University of Miami and the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis. He has been conducting research in spinal cord injury for 30 years since becoming interested during medical school and in his neurosurgical residency at the University of British Columbia. He earned his MD from the University of Alberta and his PhD in neuroscience from the University of Miami. His PhD was mentored by Richard and Mary Bunke, in which he studied the transplantation of cells for repair of the spinal cord and the chronic neuropathology of spinal cord injury. He is certified by the neurosurgical boards in Canada and the US and completed advanced training in spinal surgery at the Barrow Neurological Institute. His research translates from late stage preclinical models to pivotal clinical trials, focusing on neuroprotection, axonal regeneration, neuroplasticity, rehabilitation, and deep brain and epidural neuromodulation. He has received funding from the US Department of Defense, NIH, the state of Florida, and others. He also serves leadership roles in the Reef Foundation and Spinal Research UK. Dr. Guest is co-chair of the North American Clinical Trials Network, the largest neurosurgical consortium of SCI. He has participated in multiple clinical trials in spinal cord injury, including studies with neuroprotection, cell therapy, biologics, and neuromodulation. Welcome, Dr. Guest.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Hey, Dr. Guest. If we can start with a little bit of a bibliography here, because we're probably going to use some terms that might be new for some of the listeners. Dr. Guest, you were what we call a site PI. Is that right?
That's correct, David, yes.
And PI for the listeners is principal investigator. And so why is there a site in front of your PI?
Right. So the there were multiple sites in the clinical trial. It was really nice that there were sites in Canada, the United States, and the Netherlands, and also in the UK. So that's essential to do a clinical trial expeditiously over time. Usually you need to have multiple sites and multiple principal investigators. So the principal investigators overall for the study were Dr. Chet Moritz and Dr. Delphiel Fote, who are well known for their neuroengineering and neurorehabilitation expertise respectively. So the site, the PI is responsible for the overall conduct of the study. There's always some decisions that have to be made about the inclusion and exclusion of subjects. And then things come up during the study that require further decision-making, sometimes around safety. So I was very happy to be the PI at the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis.
And for the listeners, this study, which Faria read off the full title of the paper that gives the results, but it was known in the field as the UPLIFT study, UP-LIFT, and the company that sponsored the study, which provides the device, is called Onward Medical. The device will be commercialized as what is called the ARC-EX, and ARC-EX is external because this is a non-invasive electrical spinal cord stimulation device. So, Dr. Guest, electrical stimulation generally isn't really new. It's not a really advanced technology. It's been around for a while. If I'm a person with a spinal cord injury, I've probably had electrical stimulation used as part of my rehabilitation. So what's the secret sauce here? What makes this neuromodulation device different?
David, you're right. And I mean, I think the functional electrical stimulation has been in the spinal cord injury field for a really long time. You know, often success is really bringing together multiple variables in a way that can be useful in the real world. And so we do many elegant things in research, but to implement those things in the real world is often has a significant barriers. So what happened here is that the idea of the types of currents that are utilized, biphasic currents, monophasic currents, this had been applied in sort of the periphery of the body. But in order to do that in the spinal cord, of course, you needed to be really careful about that because we just didn't know what would happen if we applied the stimulation to the spinal cord. And so it's really remarkable that we can get activation in parts of the spinal cord from these surface electrodes. And sort of the secret sauce that you were referring to is finding the level, what we call the threshold, at which to activate a particular part of the spinal cord. And that those are the sensory roots, the nerves that carry sensation from the body into the spinal cord. And so as far as we know from engineering research, the way that the stimulator activates the spinal cord is via activation of these sensory rootlets. And that, seems to be a rather safe approach because it's not directly activating the spinal cord.
So I might know someone who's had their muscles turned on by zapping the muscle. I think I've heard of things that involve brain zapping, like transcranial magnetic stimulation. So this is zapping the cord. And so if I'm to guess how this works, I sit down, the therapist turns on the device, and the device moves me. Am I getting that right?
Oh, I don't think the device moves you. I think that what's really happening here is that you want to do something, and there's a limitation on what you can do because of the neural circuits that are available to you to do that activity. So this is a type of therapy that requires the integration of what you want to do with your capabilities together with what the electrical modulation does. And we think that what it does is it amplifies your voluntary abilities. I think that's really what we think is going on. So your participation is critical. It's not going to move you. We could turn the stimulation up to a very high level and get twitching in the muscles, but that's not really what we're after. We're after effective activities of daily living.
Thank you for clarifying that, Dr. Guest. And for the listener, if you were to open this paper, which I believe is open access, and go to figure three, you're going to see that there was baseline rehabilitation done without the device. And then for all participants, the same rehabilitation was done, but the device was used during the rehabilitation. So what this might look like for you if you're using this device is that you do your standard physical therapy and the device just makes that a little bit better. So, Free, on to your question.
Yep, thank you, Dr. Guest. So it's really interesting just to, hear from your perspective on how there is this integration of the device and the capability for someone who's experiencing a spinal cord injury and, what they were able to do before without this device and how things have changed since they're using this device. What are some kind of safety features or things for patients with spinal cord injury or caregivers for these people with spinal cord injuries that they would need to be aware of before they apply the device or while they're using it, or just things for them to kind of keep an eye out if something is different or changes when they're using this?
Right. So I think that, really the interface between sort of the box and the human body are the electrodes. And so just, preparing the skin for electrode placement, it's not really that complicated. The skin needs to be clean and dry. The electrodes, whether you can reuse the electrodes, that depends upon making sure that the adhesive in the electrode is still okay. for the most part, newer electrodes are better. So, and then paying attention to what's happening with your skin if you're doing multiple cycles of stimulation over days and weeks, making sure that you're not developing skin irritation in the electrode sites is very important. And I think that, you know, that's the key thing that we need to pay attention to. It may come up the question, how long should I stimulate for? Some people might think that leaving it on, you know, for hours and hours might be better, but we really don't think that that's the case. We think that the way that the neuroplasticity works is that it's best to use a sort of a relatively shorter, very vigorous activity period, say for an hour, than, for example, leaving it on for many hours. We really don't know the effects that would happen if it was left on for a long duration of time.
And that's an interesting point, also the duration. Another kind of follow-up question with safety would be, the electrodes in this study where they were applied over the cervical spine, like above where someone might have had surgery or hardware placed, and also below that area. Is there any complications or any, you know, safety risks to note for if placing these electrodes over hardware in the spine? Is that something that is okay to do for someone who is interested in this?
Yeah, I think we know from the study that probably the majority of people who received the stimulation had some type of indwelling plates or screws. There may be some effects, you know, on the patterns of the current within the body that are altered by these devices, but currently we don't see any problem. It's not like a magnetic resonance, for example, where you can have heating. You know, of metals in the body. This doesn't seem to do that. And so right now we're not aware of any limitations due to indwelling devices like metal plates.
Thank you for clarifying those safety points, Dr. Guest. So moving on from risk and getting toward the benefits here, you can see from the figures we saw, you know, the news talking about this, that there were benefits, that this did help people, targeting people with cervical spinal cord injuries, tetraplegia, and the function of their arm and hands. So when we're talking about that upper extremity motor strength recovery, how much recovery are we talking about here? Was this like they can totally use their arms and hands again? Can you talk a little bit about the ceiling of recovery?
Yeah, it's important not to overstate the case. And so the people who responded best were individuals who had at least a little bit of function in their hands, even if that was a very small amount of movement. And so, you know, we measured recovery in terms of changes in force. So we used what are called dynamometers to measure the pinch force and the grasp force. So people could improve by several newtons of force. And that's often enough, for example, to effectively utilize something with your hand. You know, when we look at the mean values in terms of motor points of recovery, there were approximately three. I think it was 2.8 on average motor points were recovered, and then there was a recovery of sensation of several motor points. It's important to point out that. There was heterogeneity in terms of the magnitude of recovery experienced. There were some people who had, you know, transformative recovery in the sense that they recovered the ability to transfer themselves, which is a very important part of daily life with spinal cord injury. And then there were people who experienced lesser degrees of recovery. There were also some other changes. If you look at the secondary outcomes that are included in the study, we were particularly interested in the effect on spasticity, and we observed some improvements in spasticity in our subjects.
Thanks for those clarifications, Dr. Guest. But if we can ask you to further clarify here, I don't know what a Newton is. I probably don't even know what a Newton feels like, even if I can make one. Can you give us, for maybe the average responder here, maybe a functional task equivalent? Maybe you have a success story of something someone could do with their hand that they couldn't do before, that the everyday listener might be able to, something they would be doing at home.
Right. So in just in terms of the hand and fingers, so what we observed was that Pico could have more precision. So we did a lot of tasks that, for example, would be like tapping on a cell phone, tapping numbers or tapping areas on the cell phone in order to have a sufficient contact. The ability to just manipulate objects, for example, phones and move them, towards the ear. A lot of this sort of device enablement, which is really about using, the research device to allow us to use the devices that are available to us more effectively. That was a big part of what we saw in the study. But we also saw improvements in, proximal arm strength. So, for example, the ability to lift a water bottle was very common assessment. And so we saw individuals who went from really not being able to lift a bottle containing any meaningful amount of fluid to being able to lift on both sides to the height of their shoulders.
And just jumping off of that, of the paper kind of talked about who is considered a responder versus a non-responder, and that was you were kind of talked about like the pinch grasp and overall like strength testing. What was the criteria for determining like who is going to respond, especially in a lot of people who haven't done any of these tests before? Was the bar for being a responder higher or lower?
When you say higher or lower, do you mean what exactly do you mean by that?
So, if depending on if someone is responding, like is there a certain like threshold that you need to achieve, like with your fine pinch grasp or just overall grasp, that is going to like, kind of push you over to like you would if you applied this, you would do very well with it, or you don't have enough motor strength in your upper in your arm that it's not going to be as beneficial.
Yeah. So the way that we thought about that with the data is kind of the probability that a given sort of pattern of neurological function would be associated with being a responder in the study. And the paper does actually have a figure that shows sort of the threshold baseline values that were associated with being a responder. But for the most part, I think that it was really important looking at sort of the grasp test and the grasp hand function and grasp prehension that there was at least minimal motor function in the hand. That was really a critical parameter for a response to the stimulation.
For the listeners, GRASP is an acronym for a task that involves grasping, and it's a test that can be done with some, pretty common household equipment. But is that test challenging, Dr. Guess? Like, is it if someone passes the GRASP threshold and they're a responder, does that meaningfully translate to their everyday life?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And so, this question of meaningfulness, we talk about, for example, the SCIM measure, which is the spinal cord independence measure. And we're always trying to find the relationship between the things we're measuring and the ability to do meaningful tasks of daily living. So there was some improvement in that SCIM outcome measure in the study as well, and that test is broadly accepted as having a relationship to really improve daily function.
Awesome. So, Dr. Guest, coming up here on some of the final bigger picture questions for many people, let's say someone with a spinal cord injury for multiple years, they've heard so many times about exciting new breakthroughs, technologies in the medical, management, but more specifically, treatment of spinal cord injury, technologies that might be like recoveries. And then they double click on that, news. website, and they learn that this can only be implemented in the earliest phases of spinal cord injury. And so them as a chronic cord, it doesn't apply to them. Can you give them a message of hope here from this study of what this technology means for the kind of old timers, those that have been living with spinal cord injury for quite some time?
Yeah, David, that's a great point. And I think it was super encouraging in the study that there was no apparent relationship between how long you had had your injury versus whether you were a responder or not. And one of our subjects had been injured for 34 years, and he made a very nice response that was very meaningful to him. So I think that that tells us a lot about the capabilities of the nervous system, even long after the injury has occurred.
And on that message of hope, we have recent word from the US FDA that this device has been approved for clinical use. It is no longer an investigational or experimental device, and hopefully coming to a clinic near you. So, Dr. Guest, for someone with a spinal cord injury hoping to get access to this technology, two-part question. One, do you have anything you want them to know about the technology, as the, end user? And two, how do you suggest that they advocate to get access?
Yeah, so I guess the one thing that I would say about the technology is that for the moment, this is not something to just buy and take home. We really need the participation of skilled therapists here to help the individual get the most out of the use of the device and also to help them use it safely. In terms of advocacy, so there would, I think that advocacy is very important at the level of clinics in terms of encouraging them to obtain these units for use and also to get the adequate training for their therapists and also to develop a training package for people who are going to be using this so that they understand what the main principles are so they can get the most out of it. And we've sort of discussed that already, the, how hard you try, and really working at the peak of your current abilities is a very important part of getting the most value from using the device.
Well, there you have it, folks. You've heard from Dr. Guest, one of the site PIs on the Uplift study, about this exciting, newly approved, now called ARC-EX technology. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Guest.
It was terrific to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The paper discussed in this episode was chosen on the recommendation of Asia's Research Committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your producer hosts, David McMillan, Priya Kalik, and Marla Petriello. Our production assistant editor, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at SCI Perspectives Podcast@gmail.com.